This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm here today at Ellis Island in the studio with two gentlemen who were in the Coast Guard stationed at Ellis Island at varying times for varying lengths of time. So it is May 18th, 1994, and I'll ask each of the gentlemen here to introduce themselves, and then we'll take it from there. Do you want to start, Mr. Rubinsky?
Yes. My name is Ludwig Rubinsky, or Lud as they call me, and I live in Niantic, Connecticut.
And when were you here at Ellis Island?
I arrived at Ellis Island on September 18th, 1940.
And what was your capacity at that time?
I enlisted at the barge office in New York in the morning, and I was told to report with a toothbrush and a little toilet article kit. And in short order, I was put on a ferry, and I arrived at Ellis Island, I guess it was, if I remember correctly, early in the afternoon. And so began my indoctrination into the Coast Guard as an apprentice seaman.
And how long were you here for that stint?
I was here for 3 or 4 months. I'd have to check my records, but I'd say under 4 months. And after I completed my training as a recruit, I was transferred overseas on a boat called the Chauncey Depew, which since became pretty famous, and it's now, I think, in mothballs down in Chesapeake Bay. But this was an excursion liner that they commandeered, I guess, to bring military personnel. And I was transferred to Sandy Hook, and then I went down halfway on the hook to a station called Spermaceti Cove, which is the site of one of the first Coast Guard stations in the country.
And when was that?
That was in late 1940. Still in 1940.
Still 1940.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you came again to Ellis Island. What was that specific circumstance?
Well, the next time I came to Ellis Island was during, let's see, I guess we decommissioned a ship in New York Harbor. I was on the USS Cepheus at the end of the war. And when the ship was decommissioned in Red Bank, I then had orders to proceed to Ellis Island. It was then a receiving station. And that was my second stint, you might say, here at Ellis Island.
And how long did you stay at that time?
I think I was only here a matter of weeks. We were quartered, we ate, and sort of just passed the time until things began to settle down. People were transferred and reported here, you know.
And where did you go when you left here that time?
Let me see now. I guess I was transferred to St. George, one of the time after that, and I went on several units. I was on a cutter Rush for a while. I was on a Galatea, I think, for a matter of weeks, but we operated out of St. George Base. It was a big Coast Guard base there, and then I went on, I guess, to I'm having a hard time getting my facts straight now.
Okay, I'm gonna. Okay, we're resuming now, and you had been here at the receiving station in 1943.
That's wrong.
And then the next.
No, that's wrong.
Oh, okay.
It's definitely. I reported here at the receiving station in 45.
Oh, in 45.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course, I had gotten orders. See, in the interim, I got transferred to the academy. I was still an enlisted man. And I got orders, and I was transferred to the academy, and they had some kind of a course of instruction, and I got a commission. And then when I completed that course at the academy, I got transferred to the USS Cepheus. And that was a Coast Guard manned attack transport. I proceeded from New London, Connecticut to San Francisco. to report to this USS Cepheus. So when I got to San Francisco, it started sort of a saga of going like halfway around the world chasing this ship for at least 3 or 4 months, and I had something like 29 endorsements on my orders. I traveled all over the islands in the Pacific, Manila, Japan, all over the Pacific. And then they received word that the ship was docked at the terminal Alameda, California, and about 4 months later I flew back to Alameda, and there was the ship at the same dock that I started out at.
This is the Cepheus?
Yeah. Cepheus, yes.
How do you spell that?
C-E-P-H-E-U-S. That was the AKA-18. Okay. So anyway, I stayed with the ship. We made some trips around, and then we had orders to go through the canal and proceed to New York Harbor to Red Hook section of Brooklyn, where the ship was decommissioned, and I was one of the last two people left aboard as decommissioning detail. So when that was my duty was completed, I had orders to report to Ellis Island, and that was the next time I reported as the receiving station.
Okay.
And I was here for, I guess, a couple of weeks, just sort of living and waiting for orders and eating.
And then there was a third time.
Well, in the ensuing years after that, I was here again on between assignments, and by that time I had gotten malaria, so I had all three kinds of malaria, I remember, and I was sent home from the South Pacific to San Francisco, and I eventually wound up in this area, and I had to report to the Marine Hospital a couple of times for treatment.
Uh-huh. Do you remember what year that was?
That is very hazy in my memory. No, I'd have to consult my memoirs or whatever.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Wow. So we'll delve into all of that in a while. Why don't you introduce yourself and say when you were here? Were you here more than one time?
I was here about four times.
Oh, good. Okay.
My name is William Dorville, and I enlisted in the Coast Guard. And the regular Coast Guard in Minneapolis, Minnesota, was shipped to Omaha, Nebraska. They lined us up and they said, count off, 1, 2, 1, 2. All number ones will step forward, all number twos will step back. All number ones will go to New York City, and all number twos will go to Port Angeles, Washington. So our detail, part went west and part went east. I can remember the first time I hit New York City we came off of the Pennsylvania Railroad and got into on the subway, and it's an experience for the first time, a rural boy coming from Minnesota, hearing this roar coming down these subway tubes, and seeing this thing come out of a tunnel, and you get on it, and you went down to South Ferry and walked across the street and got on a ferry boat to take us over to Ellis Island, and which was supposed to be our boot camp. Well, when we got here to Ellis Island, the war had broken out.
Now, where?
This was from December 1941. And they gave us an issue of what issue of clothing they could give us, and they had no sea bags. They gave us a mattress cover, and we dumped our stuff in a mattress cover, and I was here until, well, we were supposed to have a boot camp here, but everything being so hectic in the latter part of December of 41, kind of boot camp just fell apart, and the first thing we knew, I think about the 3rd of January of 42, we were shipped across over to Ellis Island, over to Seaman Church Institute. That was the old building down on South Ferry, and it had a tower. They made a new Seaman Church Institute up on the other side of the park, but this was the old building, and we was stationed there for about a week. And all I can remember is that each day they'd give us a strip of 5-cent meal tickets. And we'd go downstairs in the cafeteria, and breakfast would cost us maybe 5 tickets, and lunch would cost us 7 tickets, and supper would cost us 10 tickets. And we were there for about, oh, I'd say about a week before we got orders to go out. And I was sent out to Napeg out in Long Island, which was a Coast Guard surf station. And I was there. I got more or less my boot camp there, learning how to go out through the surf and come back through the surf. And we did quite a few rescues on the east coast off of Long Island of the ships that were being sunk off there in 42. And then I was also involved in the submarine, the German submarine that came in on Long Island. Indirectly, I reported the submarine that night and went to sleep and slept through the whole darn episode. Everybody yelled, running up and down the beach chasing the submarine. I was sound asleep. Then I think I came back to Ellis Island in September. I had requested quartermaster school, and my commanding officer okayed the orders, and I came back to Ellis Island in September of 42 to go to quartermaster signal school here on the island. I was here in signal school for maybe a couple weeks. It was supposed to be, I think, a 16-week school or something like that. And coming back from Liberty one Friday night on the old ferry boat, I ran into an accident. Somebody pushed me down a ladder, and I sprained my ankle. And next day on the base is Saturday, is always inspection. And Saturday in the receiving station here was always cornbread and baked beans and coffee. And it was something that the cooks would make up the night before, clean up their galleys, and go for inspection the next day. So I had cornbread and baked beans that morning. I went over to the sick bay because my ankle had swollen up. And they said, "Get out of here. The inspecting officers are coming. You can't hang around now." And so I hobbled out, and I hobbled out right in the path of the inspecting officers. And they said, "What's the matter, sailor?" And I said, "Well, I think I sprained my ankle." And he said, "Well, you get back there in sick bay." And I didn't think I made very good friends with the pharmacist mate. But they shipped me over to the hospital, the Marine Hospital, on the other side of the island. So I was there for, a week or so.
This is September 42?
Now I would say probably I'm in October of 42. And I was there for a while, and then they shipped me down to, they didn't know whether it was actually broken or not, or whether it sprained, and they shipped me down to Stapleton, Staten Island. Yeah, the Marine Hospital down there at Stapleton. And I was there for 4 solid months. And they finally, I went in, and the doctors gave me a physical down there, and I ended up with, it was tonsillectomy, and so they took my tonsils out, and then he said, "You've got that double rupture." And I said, "I never had a double rupture before in my life." But as long as you're going to stay here for your rupture. So that's why I stayed 4 months at that hospital. And I finally came back to Ellis Island, was then shipped out to Short Beach on Long Island, and was there for maybe a month.
This is now early 43.
It'd be early 43. Still requesting quartermaster school, so they shipped us up to Bridgeport, Connecticut, to a quartermaster school up there. And we lived in a mansion up there, which was one of these beautiful estates up on top of the hill overlooking the Long Island Sound that the government had taken over. And we got quartermaster school up there. Then I was shipped back to Ellis Island for assignment. Was assigned to Pier 9 East River, which at that time was a Coast Guard base. And the small boats, they used to keep the small boats there. And we was on a signal detachment in New York Harbor here. We had a signal tower at Seaman Church Institute, barge office, Statue of Liberty, Staten Island out at St. George, and then Bush Terminal in Brooklyn. And I was on that detail all for, I guess, about 4 or 5 months.
So you were a signalman?
Yes. I was at that time a quartermaster. And which, you know, you'd get the same rating quartermaster signalman. You were QMQS or QMQ. And I asked for a transfer because I wanted to get back out to get some sea duty in like a dang fool. So I came back to Ellis Island for orders and was shipped then to the West Coast to pick up a ship. And that's the last I saw of Ellis Island.
So when was that last time?
I was probably be 44 when I was lay here last.
Okay.
And but I had a friend of mine that shipped in with me, stayed here on the island the whole enlistment. And so when I came out of the service, and I was discharged out in the Army base out in Tacoma, Washington, and Fort Lewis.
What year was that?
That was the latter part of 45. And so I came back to New York City to renew a couple of old female, you know, girlfriends I had out here. And I came over to the island to see my buddy who had stayed the whole enlistment here in Ellis Island as a yeoman, and I came back to see him. And but that was 45. That's almost 49 years ago. That 51 years when I last here, but 49 years when I last visit.
Wow. Okay. Well, why don't we start by saying, when you first joined the Coast Guard, do you remember what the impetus was for you to join, what you expected, or how you felt about signing up with the Coast Guards?
Well, mine, it's hard in retrospect now, because when I enlisted in September 1940, obviously when you review history, we were on the brink of war, but I sure as heck didn't know it. And I had been going to Stevens Institute of Technology, and I went there for 2 years, and then I decided I always evidently had a bent in for seafaring in my heart. So I announced to my parents that I wanted to enlist in the Coast Guard. So I'm sure that kind of thoroughly broke their heart. But at that time, you know, there was no, as far as I knew, you know, there was no emergency. Well, actually, there wasn't. See. So,
do you know how you had that bent for going to the sea? Do you know where that came from?
Well, I'm a New Yorker, born and bred, but evidently it was from a very young age. I was very good friends with a schoolmate of mine. His father was the superintendent for all the Sailor Snug Harbor buildings down in Greenwich Village, and they owned a.
He probably got it from riding the subway. I mean, the ferry back and forth across New York Harbor.
Right. But I never got seasick on the ferry. Anyway, I have snapshots of myself. You know, we were teenagers, tender teenagers. We'd go out to South Old Long Island, and his father owned a little cabin cruiser, a 30-foot cabin cruiser, and we would spend our summers out there. We'd ferry people in and out from fishing boats, and we had a great time. So yeah, that was it. So I announced my decision, and that's how I decided on the Coast Guard. But anyway,
how you felt about it? What you I guess the country was on the brink of war, but you
but
weren't
But it had
really
nothing to do with my feelings or my actions, believe me. That I'm so positive of. And when I completed my training, can I back up to my
sure.
some of the things I forgot? Yeah,
so
I won't rust this. That happened to me here. When I reported here to boot camp, your anecdote sort of re-jolted my memory. We arrived here in the island, and of course I was a raw kid. I didn't know what to expect. I have a lot of memories there, but very.
How old were you?
About 19.
Wait, what's your birth date, by the way? I wanted to get that information.
2/7/20.
Mine is 1/31/22.
Okay, so you were around 19.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, when I arrived at the island here, and we were kind of kicked around with a couple of tough old Mastodons. I remember the name Archie Weeks. He was a skinny, salty-looking dog. He was a bosun mate. And he'd go through the barracks with his club. He'd carry a club at his belt, and he'd wrap the steel bunks and would get up, sailors, daylight in the swamps, you know, and a few other vulgarities. And but in the middle of our training, we used to muster out on this field, back of this porch I was telling you about. That's where we did all our drill and everything else. Well, one day they lined us all up, and by the numbers, you know, we'd say 1, 2, you step back, and 3, 4, you step back, and they took half the detail and transferred them to Algiers, Louisiana. So just on a fluke, I escaped that fate. Yeah. These fellows were transferred down there, and they opened another boot camp there, and I'm sure we got the better of the deal.
Yeah.
Then, when I finished my training, as I said, on this Chauncey Depew, we went to Sandy Hook, overseas, actually, and we trained at this station. And that is where, also, I got this terrific training, which has stood me in good stead for the rest of my life. Every day of the week, winter, summer, we would launch a boat, a pulling boat, through the surf here on Sandy Hook on the ocean side. We'd have a wagon, we'd pull down, take the wheels off, launch it, jump in, and start rowing. And boy, there was some pretty healthy grousing about that. But it was training that I would never forget in my life. Well, when I finished there, I got transferred to Atlantic City. And Atlantic City, if you could picture this, at that time was a little hometown. There were 14 Coast Guardsmen there. Later on, I think they established a signalman school and a few other
yeah.
things there, but there was just a lifeboat station. So that was pretty interesting duty. And they built a new lifeboat station on the other side of the inlet, and we used to commute back and forth and stand watches there. Well, I was standing on watch there one night in the boathouse, and a teletype machine began to clatter, and I watched my name come out. By then, I made third class. I was a coxswain, and I watched my name come out, and it was transferred to Naval Operating Base, Norfolk, Virginia, like the next day almost. So this was on the 4th of December. So we reported in, I guess it was the 5th, and we went to this big barracks and a naval operating base there, and I went home on Liberty to New York. And I was home in the dining room. My folks, my sister, were having breakfast on December the 7th when news came of Pearl Harbor. So it said, you know, all personnel report back to their station. So I went back to Norfolk, and all that day, Sunday, you know, planes would be shipped down the streets in the NOB with their wings folded back, and they were loading them on the aircraft carriers. And then a couple of days later, I had orders to report to this USS Alhena, which was also an AKA. It was AKA-9.
How do you spell that?
Alhena. Now, we just had a reunion 2 weeks ago in Fall River, and I mean, we had quite a gathering. It was something else. People I hadn't seen for some 50 years.
Okay, well, let's have Bill catch us up to here. Do you remember how you felt about going into the Coast Guard? What were the circumstances in your life?
I grew up in Minnesota. Graduated in 1940 from the public high school there. Went to, at that time, there was a government program called NYA, which was long before your days, I know that. And it was a training program that the government had. And I went and took up aviation machinist mate. And had about a 4-month course in that.
What was the NYA standing for?
National Youth Recovery Act. Remember that? Oh, that like WPA, only it was a younger group. So I had this training and repairing aircraft engines. So I thought that this would be a good time to go to Canada because they went into war in 1939, and I joined the RAF up there. Well, I was underage. They stopped me at the border, shipped me home. I applied to the Chinese government to go with the Flying Tigers. I got as far as Chicago with the Chinese government. The police stopped me and shipped me home again the second time. And my folks said, if you're so anxious to join the darn service, we'll let you join the Coast Guard. Because the Coast Guard is a nice, peaceful operation. And you'll be probably stationed at Split Rock Lighthouse up in the north coast of Superior, Lake Superior, or you'll be at some nice little receiving station along the coast, and you will be, you know, not afraid of what you're getting into trouble. So they signed the papers for the Coast Guard. So that's the reason I went into the Coast Guard. Not that I had anything against the Coast Guard, but I was. And then when I got in the Coast Guard, they looked at it and said, oh, you're a qualified aviation machinist mate. I said, but I don't want to be an aviation machinist mate. I want to be a quartermaster. So that's why I went to quartermaster school.
Was that the common folklore or whatever you want to say about attitude about the Coast Guard, that was a safer branch?
Well, a lot of people thought it was a nice, safe operation.
No, I'd say that was an official attitude because while I was, as a matter of fact, like making the landings on Guadalcanal, friends back home in New York were telling my parents, well, Lud is in the Coast Guard. You know, you really don't have to worry. He's guarding the coast someday.
Yes.
And my folks would become quite wild up.
He's talking about he received a commission in the Coast Guard. I went, after I got out of the Coast Guard, I went to university and got my degree and applied for a Coast Guard commission. In the meantime, I had joined the Naval Reserve. Why? At that time, there was no Coast Guard Reserve in the area. So I joined the Naval Reserve. And it was going to school at the time. It was that extra little money that gave me some beer money and a movie once in a while. And so you took the blood money from the government. And then along comes, I got married in the meantime. I'm at work one day and my wife called up and she's all in tears. She says, your Navy pay came today and also a big fat envelope for the United States Navy. Greetings. Come back in the Korea War. So I went back in the Korean service. In the meantime, I had applied for a Coast Guard commission. So I reported to New York City. I had my orders changed so that I could report to New York City because my wife was a New York City girl. So she went home with her mother and father. I reported to Brooklyn Navy Yard for assignment. I got assigned to the USS Wright aircraft carrier, which was stationed in Pensacola, Florida. In the meantime, my Coast Guard commission came through. I go to my commanding officer and I said to him, I said, I'd like to get a discharge. He said, with me all. I said, but I got a commission. He said, well, when the Coast Guard give you your commission, I'll have to release you. They won't give me a commission when I'm in another military service. So it was one of these catch-22s. So we argued back and forth for about 6 months. In the meantime, my Navy Reserve enlistment was running out, And I said to the commanding officer, "You can keep your Navy. I'm not going to accept the Coast Guard commission. As soon as I get out of this bloody service, I'm going to go home." Because at that time, if I'd accept the commission, I would have had to put another 2 years in. And this was in 1951, so I would have been another 2 years with the Coast Guard, which carried me to 53. So I said, "Well, if you won't give me a discharge so I can accept a commission, I won't take the commission. I'll finish out my Naval Reserve time, and then I'm going to kiss you all goodbye." And that's what I did.
Where were you when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and did that affect you in your
service? Somewhere between Minneapolis and Omaha.
And were you dispatched to?
Well, then we shipped here to New York City for boot camp. Boot camp in New York at Ellis Island was supposed to be we went out in front of that little grassy area in front of the building there, and we had a Navy chief out there, or not a Navy chief, a Coast Guard chief, and he was instructed the guys for walking, marching, and I have two left feet, and he finally told me, he said, "Why don't you go sit down on the grass over there and watch for a while?" So next day, they were out marching. I went in the barracks and went to sleep.
Well, now, what else did boot camp consist of?
We did some rowing here in the harbor, in longboats.
Yeah.
I remember the first time we went out there, they said ship oars or toss oars, and the guys really tossed the oars, which didn't make our bosun very angry. I don't know whether he was here when there was a German U-boat commander stationed here on the island, had served in World War I in the German Navy, had come to the States, joined the Coast Guard, and was stationed here on the island. And I cannot, for the life of me, think of his name.
I thought it was something like, couldn't be. It was a German name?
German name.
Yes, I've been trying to recall that, but I can't.
But he was a character. He was really a character. He spoke
was
with
the
a...
Coast Guard?
Yes.
Iraq,
yeah.
In the
yes. Yeah, but he spoke with a real thick German accent. Achtung! That type of thing. And it was... But we used to have some fun here on the island. It was our liberties... To Manhattan, coming back at 11 o'clock at night. If we missed that ferry boat at 11 o'clock in the night, that meant that you slept in the park bench over in the Battery Park, and because the next boat didn't come till about 7:30 in the morning. And some of the nights were cold. I remember doing guard duty here on New Year's Eve, in 1942, on the North Seawall. And it was, I had every stitch of clothing that the government gave me. Sweater, jumper, pea coat. I think I even had probably a double jumper on. And it was cold. It was 4 degrees above. And I did see, we had at that time intern some Japanese internees that was quartered in those buildings back in the hospital units. And they had guard duty on those. I don't know where the guys would have gone if they decided to go out of the building, but they couldn't get off the island.
So these were people that were Japanese Americans who were being detained here.
Probably so.
Uh-huh.
There was maybe a half a dozen of them.
Did you speak to them?
No, we weren't allowed to speak to them.
They were, I guess the Coast Guard had an armed guard detail or something. They seized, at one time, they seized all the merchant ships in the port of New York. Italian,
Germans,
Japanese, things like that. But see, my memories, you have to understand that Ellis Island is strictly during that original stint, strictly peacetime. There was no air of any kind of emergency at all. We drilled. We had close order drill where they'd say to the rear march, and everybody would pile up in a heap. We had a war drill, flags, and things like that. But basically, you know, that was it.
Mm-hmm. I got more boot camp out at Napay, out at Amagansett, Long Island.
Than you did here.
Than I did here.
Because
yeah. Uh-huh. When the once war broke out, we were, they just farmed us out as fast as they could. Because they had thousands of kids coming in right behind us. And at that time, I guess Curtis Bay,
Curtis Bay, Maryland. Yeah.
Curtis Bay, Maryland was being opened up. And also Cape May was probably being opened up at receiving station, the training station, boot camp.
What was the relationship between the detainees due to the Second World War who were here and the Coast Guard? Was there any connection between the deportation or immigration aspect of the island and what you were doing?
I just think that they were stationed here because it was some place to put them. Instead of putting them in a jail in New York City that the I don't know whether at that time Governor's Island was First Army, and I don't know whether they had facilities to hold Japanese people or not. I guess we just inherited the Japanese, and as I say, there was only about six of them that I understood.
But you were there more than that, Mr. Fitzgerald?
I don't know. Really, I wasn't involved in any of that. But I do, you know, I heard that at the time relations were pretty friendly between the Coast Guardsmen that were on this armed guard detail and the detained merchant seamen. They were pretty friendly. Italians are noted for being very friendly and whatever, so it was a jovial relationship.
We used to, when I was stationed here in the signal school, they would ask for, we'd be off duty on the weekends or there'd be some time, we'd have some free time. And we used to bum rides on the picket boats that go down to Cavan Point to the ammunition depot down there.
What's a picket boat?
38 footers. The small, at that time, the standard at that time, Coast Guard vessel. It was a harbor vessel, diesel powered, 38 feet long. It usually had two or three men assigned to it, usually a bosun and a couple seamen. And we'd get a ride down to Cavan Point. I remember one day they closed the school up and they loaded us all up on a ferry boat. And I don't think it was, maybe it was a ferry boat that operated back and forth, but I don't remember that. But they took us down to Bayonne and the USS Randall. AP-116 was in dry dock down there, and it was a Coast Guard man, was to be a Coast Guard man transport, and you had to bring all the supplies aboard, and the supplies go aboard, buggy lugging them aboard, and so they took about 50 guys off the island and put them on this, I think it was probably a tugboat they took us down on. But we went down there to Bayonne and worked all day long carrying boxes of groceries and spare parts and whatever needed to go aboard that ship to put it in commission. And then we thought, well, maybe we'll get assigned to that handle because they're looking for crew members. But we didn't make it.
Well, let's see. So, is there anything about Ellis Island that you recall from the times that you were here? Either what it looked like or what, anything.
I can remember when we stationed here in Ellis Island, we used to walk up to the old, at that time, the old immigration building, which was opened. It was filthy, probably 2 inches of dust on the floor, papers spread all around, chairs turned upside down. It looked like a deserted old building at that time. But we knew that it was the immigration building, and we'd come up and stick our nose in the door and look around.
Did either of you by any chance have immigrant parents who came through Ellis Island?
My father was born in Russia when he was 6 months old. He came to this country. On my mother's side of family, yes, I imagine they came through. I've never really checked on them.
So was that any kind of a feeling you had for the place because of your own family?
Not really. Uh-huh. No, I didn't at the time.
No, I hadn't. My folks came pretty much through New England, Boston. My great-grandmother came into New York in early 1830s, but I don't think she came in from Santo Domingo, and I don't think that she ever went through an immigration. I think she got in a boat and came in the harbor and got off the boat and
went about her business.
I don't think from 1830 that they was. If I can go political for just a second, I think they ought to reopen Immigration Island, the Ellis Island up for immigrants, and make everybody that comes in this country come in illegally and go through an immigration. Because we are taking immigrants in now. There was no rhyme or reason.
Yeah. Where did your family come from when they came?
The Dorval part came from France, and I'm a hybrid. My father is French and English, basically, and my mother is Scotch, Irish, and Dutch. And I imagine my mother's side of the family came through Pennsylvania and out to Iowa that way, and the French came into New York City, and then the English part came in from Boston, Connecticut, on across the country. I have a hobby of genealogy, and I can talk for hours on that.
Let's see. So anything else about Ellis Island? Do you remember anything that struck you about the island itself when you were here?
Not really. I remember. I have, flashes of memories. I remember going down in underground passages, like to get over to the other side of the island and under the hospital. You could look or walk for miles, and there were tunnels with huge steam pipes in them. And this is how you could get from here to there without going outside. Mm-hmm. But it looks like things have very much changed right now.
Well, now, neither of you were housed or had meals or anything in what this major building that's been restored called the Great Hall.
No, because that was not that the Coast Guard building. Didn't have that.
Okay.
The building I think that which is marked in the map, and from the shape of the building, must be this baggage dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been the building that we were housed in, because as I visualized it, we'd come in and go through the ferry terminal and then come around and walk around there.
That's right.
And as you came into this building, it was a open building. As you came in, there was a first aid area along your left-hand side. A master arm shack there. Then the rest of it was dining area, table, and on the far right would be the kitchen area. Then you kind of went through a low partition, and that was the berthing area, double-deck bunk. And he was talking about the guy coming through at 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning with a stick and then going down the bunks and going rattle, rattle, rattle right down the bunks. And another thing that they used to do, the guys would come in drunk. And we had lockers, standing lockers, the old Navy high school type lockers, so wide, so tall. Mm-hmm. He'd come in and they would not bolt it down. And if you gave them a good shove, they'd act like dominoes. And they'd go crash, 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 and everybody's shaving lotion and everything else would be broken, and the place would smell awful. And the bosun mates would come running in, and we did push-ups, runarounds, out there in the middle of January.
For doing that.
Well, they run everybody out.
Everybody
went out.
Be up and out.
Up and out. And you'd go out there in underwear, shorts and T-shirts. They wouldn't let you put shoes or socks on or clothes on. And you're out there in middle of January doing some runarounds or push-ups.
If there was an unruly incident and you could be an angel and fast asleep, they would... His description of the layout is that's the way it was. There's no question about that. If you were unruly or something happened, they would turn on all the lights, and they would huge reflector lights all over this barracks, and I mean it was like daylight. And then they would start screaming, "All right, sailors, you know, out," and you'd have to get out your bunk outside and do push-ups or some punishment like that. Yeah. That's the way it was.
Oh, and I always liked, they used to... You try, especially if you had an upper bunk. You'd lay there, and the lights would come on.
Well, that was reveille every morning, too, because, you know, when you're not used to that, you know, and you're a young lad, and you're sound asleep, and then all of a sudden, daylight with these glaring lights, and then this furore, get up and out, get dressed, you know. It was different.
How were you treated by the high-ranking officers when you were here?
I don't ever remember being maltreated. I know all the young, like a lieutenant, became admirals and all that. And this Captain Mazzotta, who was in charge of the receiving station, I don't know whether you remember that name or not, but we were stationed in Atlantic City together. He was an officer in charge of the group there, and you know, we were pretty well treated. I had no complaints.
I don't think we saw too many officers.
No,
the officers were in that. The enlisted men stayed over here in this mm-hmm. building. Mm-hmm. Your chiefs were. I don't even know if the chiefs lived on that floor or not, or whether they had some other place. I can't remember the chiefs being there. Most of your officers lived over on the other side.
The other island. Yeah. There's like, this is called Island 1, then there's 2 and 3.
They live over in probably in 2. Uh-huh. And that was where the office was. The only thing I can remember, when I was here for the first time for quartermaster school, they had a change of command. And they found everybody out on the field, and I don't know where that field was.
I think I will pass that when we go for the walk.
But we lined up there, and I'm a year ahead of myself, because this was the following year. This was to be in 42. I'm quite sure it's 42. They lined us all up. They mustered everybody out, and we all fell out for changing of officers. And we stood out there for about a half hour. It seemed like they always have to have you standing there for a half hour while he's down chatting with the somebody else before he finally makes his presentation and comes out, and then there's a rigmarole of one saluted the other, and here's the keys to the place. And you're now in charge of the Ellis Island. And the other guy says, "I'm off to Timbuktu." But
I remember a little more about things now. When you came off the ferry and you walked up the ramp and into the building, there was a old wooden desk with a little rail around it. And that's where the quartermaster used to check in the Liberty Party. As you went in, it was in the left-hand corner. And that's where this quartermaster, who I can remember as if it were yesterday, was... his last name was Carl Ludwig, and he wore a watch cap all the time, about a quarter of an inch over his eyebrows, a real salty character. And then there was a personnel officer here named Sam Swit, because that was a name I remember. As a matter of fact, I've looked him up and I've called him a couple of times and we've reminisced about Ellis Island, things like that. See, he was an ensign or a JD or something like that when I was here as an apprentice seaman, but I've kept in touch with him. But he's up there, see. This Captain Mazzotta, unfortunately, has died, as a matter of fact, and I tried to contact his widow, who is, you know, up there in years, and I tried to get some memorabilia out of them, because I imagine he's got quite a collection, but it's all sort of sealed up in their house, and their daughters want no part of, you know, going through anything, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I told her I was coming here, you know.
Uh-huh.
She kind of got a glimmer of excitement, mm-hmm. said, mm-hmm. you know, let me know, or write her a letter or so, which I intend to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Well, I think probably my stay in Ellis Island, either as in coming in as a receiving station or as a training school, was a good experience. I said the Saturday morning breakfast, because of inspection, was always cornbread and beans, but the rest of the meals were fairly decent meals, a GI issue. It wasn't like mother's home cooking or anything like that.
Seems to me they had regular wooden tables that folded up with steel legs, then
yeah.
two benches, one on each side.
On each side.
Every once in a while, a bench would go down, collapse,
yeah.
and everybody would go sliding mm-hmm. off, and there'd be a little furor about
and
that.
And there was always those bleached benches.
Right.
And bleached tables.
Everything was washed down with bleach. Deck was scrubbed every night, things like that. Yeah.
Had a little edge around it. It was reminded of when they got on the ship, you used to have, especially on the smaller ships, I don't know on your bigger ships, I served time aboard seagoing tugs, and we used to have our mess table would have foul weather boards that would be put over your table and have cutouts. There'd be a cutout for your plate and a cutout for your coffee. And you could set your plate there and your coffee there, and no matter how bad the ship rolled or tossed or turned, your plate wouldn't go sliding down into the next guy. You guess you maybe had boards like that too.
I remember I was introduced to my first movie on the mess deck one night at boot camp of the perils of sexual diseases,
oh.
which left evidently an indelible mark on me, because I was a pretty square shooting kid, I'll tell you that.
All the armed forces. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the month, every facility got an allotment of money to buy food for their mm-hmm. people for the month. And towards the end of the month, they start running low on food. Low in allotments, and so that they'd be cutting back. Now, the only way you can cut back is not to get the people to eat as much. So they'd show these VD movies right before mealtime, which would turn your appetite off.
Yeah, they were pretty stark. Yeah.
Oh, it was awesome.
The Coast Guard ran a lot on they call them commuted rations, where you got a dollar per man per day. And at these search stations, I don't know at yours, but I was at some pretty, like, if you close your eyes, you'd think you were down in Chincoteague or the Outer Banks. They were all Outer Bankmen there. You know?
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
We subsisted on, I don't know, maybe $12 a month. And then we kept the 18. And that was always equal to my salary, because my salary was $21 a month. And at Ellis Island, I had my first paycheck, which was a dollar, because I had $8.95 insurance. Even as a kid, I had a little brain, so I took out a government insurance policy. But you got paid every 2 weeks, so my first paycheck was $1. And, of course, I brought it home, showed it to my father, and he says, oh, can you cash it for me, Dad? And, of course, he cashed it and gave me $5 for liberty that stint home. But he evidently kept that check, and I brought a copy of that. That was my first paycheck.
No, $21 a day once
a month.
Month,
yeah.
We used to get paid twice a month, 1st and 15th. We'd get at a receiving station when I was out at NAPEG. We'd get paid. They'd take out insurance, 50 cents of insurance or some darn thing, CI insurance.
A savings.
But at the receiving station there, again, you was given an allotment. And it seemed like, as he says, every one of these people, there was a time when the Coast Guard had what they call surfmen. And the Coast Guard is made up of about four different branches. There was the revenue service, there was the surfmen, there was the cutter service, and then they joined all these things into one organization and called it the United States Coast Guard. And so we had a lot of our people were North Carolinians.
That's what I was trying to say.
South Carolinians. Nobody that had anything but a pair of boots into their name. And they joined the Coast Guard. And they manned most of these stations along the coast in those days as surfmen. And when I went out to NAPEG, our chief was an old-time North Carolinian. And he was a surfman. And you were more or less inducted into the United States Surfman operation, not the United States Coast Guard, because you learned how to use a breeches buoy. You know what a breeches buoy is? Well, a breeches buoy is to rescue ships stranded close by the shore. And it's a box with a series of pegs in it. And your line is flaked in this way, and then this way, this way, this way, and there's probably 1,000 feet of line, rope, to the layman, and then you had a little brass cannon, and you had a 16-pound projectile that would be put into this cannon, and the end would have a rope tied to it, and it would go feed into this box, and you would then fire this cannon. And I can't remember whether it was a shotgun shell or what,
no,
but it would project this.
It was a shell on top of the cannon with a lanyard.
And you pull it.
You're making a long thing out of this, you know. She doesn't even know what you're getting at yet.
Well, they would shoot this projectile out to the ship that's stranded off the coast.
Yes.
And it would carry this line with it.
Oh.
And once it got out there, it usually would go over the ship. They would grab the line, pull the line in, and then we'd fasten a heavier line to the light line that went out. And that would be, there would be a tripod put up on a beach to raise this line up off the water, off the ground. And then we had a bucket seat on a pulley that we could pull ourselves out to the ship and rescue the people from the ship by the breeches buoy.
And bring them ashore, one at a time.
That's right.
But what he is trying to tell you, like every week, at least once a week, you had to have this drill, a simulated drill, where they had what they call a yard arm, and you fired a cannon over that and practiced the things.
Oh, yes.
But we became pretty proficient.
And then
did you use that much?
Not really.
We did in 41, 42 rather. When you had the sinkage off the coast. We didn't use the breeches buoy as much as we used the longboats.
Boats, yeah.
And we went out with the longboats. And then the old Coast Guard saying you have to go up and you don't have to come back.
And see, that was really for sailing ships back then. But most of the time, as he says, we'd use a longboat. You know, if there was an airplane crash off the beach or something like that, we'd launch the boat the way we did every day, you know, and row out, pick everyone up, and bring them back. Mm-hmm. Or the picket boat, that was standard at the station.
Mm-hmm. But you know, there was a coxswain, usually a coxswain, in charge of the longboat, and he would have to count the waves coming in. Mm. And as you came back in through the breakers, you didn't want to go in like a surfboard.
Put end for end the boat, you know.
You had to count your waves and come in behind the waves so you wouldn't come tearing in. And it was up to the coxswain to call out his commands and to say to roll or to hold or because we came in a couple of times and spilled all over the place. And
especially the chief if you had waders on. They'd let you wear waders, you know, the high boots with little straps. And boy, if the water got in there, you were in deep trouble. But, you know, another interesting thing, see, like, his era is a little bit after mine in this respect also, that the recruits from Ellis Island, when they went to these stations, were actually the first wave of a very, very kind of shocking thing along the coast of this eastern part of the United States, because they were all staffed by Chincoteague and people like that. They had a boathouse or a station house, and then they lived in little huts, little houses around. There would be, like at Spermaceti Cove, there were 8 little houses where they all lived around. They were Grays, Aubie Gray, and
Gray was a favorite one. Oh,
and Fulcher, things like that. They were all Pritchard, related. Yeah,
Plunkett, Gray.
So anyway, when this wave of new recruits hit these lifeboat stations, it was like, to us, it was like a new world, or maybe a glimpse of the old world, and it was kind of shocking to the present inhabitants there, that were pretty hard-headed people. And, you know, there was a little friction, but we kind of got acquainted with each other. But when I got rated coxswain, this is a third-class petty officer, then we got into big trouble, because there was a chief bosun mate who was a surfman in charge of the station, and there were like 8, 10, 12 surfmen, and they were non-rated men. So all of a sudden, here's some punk kid arriving at the station.
We're beginning now tape 2, and we were talking, Mr. Rabinsky was talking about you were a first wave coming from Ellis Island, and here's this punk kid coming in, and tell the situation again.
Well, we arrived at this lifeboat station, or surf station, and the one I went to first was the one at, as I said before, at Spermaceti Cove, which is halfway down on Sandy Hook. At the time, we ate and slept in the boathouse, or the main building, but there were 8 little cottages or huts around surrounding the station, and that's where the surfmen lived, who had been there for years. And when we arrived, we were seamen. There was a little friction between us, but we got to know each other better, and we finally sort of got acclimated. But then, when the time came that I made a rate, I became a third-class petty officer, a coxswain, suddenly became the second senior man at the station. And, of course, as you can well imagine, that didn't sit too well with the rest of the troops. So I was transferred out of there. I guess it coincided with the onset of the war, but that's how they took care of that.
Uh-huh. So they were the ones that took such pride in their...
Well, they were a close-knit people. They lived on a beach all their lives. They were Coast Guardmen, surfmen.
Surfmen.
You see, it used to be known as the U.S. Life Saving Service. And as he said before, the three branches more or less merged. And I was fortunate in sort of getting a good taste of all branches, even I was a commanding officer of a lot of buoy tenders. And that, you know, I encountered people from the old lighthouse service, and there was a little bit of getting used to each other then, see, because I was I was a regular Coast Guardsman, you might say. But we got acclimated, and everything worked all right. But we met, one of the joys of coming to this receiving station at Ellis Island was sometimes it was like old home week. You'd meet people that you hadn't seen for years, or you would, meet people that were stationed at some Coast Guard station someplace else, you know, and they would all meet here at Ellis Island. But
So Ellis Island had a good reputation far as being sent here in the Coast Guard?
Yes.
There was no other place along the East Coast. The hub for the Coast Guard along the East Coast would be Boston, New York, on down. Yeah. And that all your orders, all your movement of personnel came through the Coast Guard station here.
See, the district office was right across at 42 Broadway, so that was close by, too, you know, and you would get orders from there and then proceed to Ellis Island. The reason I showed up at Ellis Island a couple of times was that, see, during the war and shortly after, when I got a commission, it was definitely a commission for temporary service. So when a year after the war's end and I thought pretty comfortable in my commission, I got noticed that I was reverting back to my permanent status of chief bosun mate. And I have a set of orders and a discharge certificate right here at receiving station Ellis Island. So I was discharged and then reenlisted and then appointed an ensign or a JG for temporary service, I forget which. So this went on and on until finally I made a permanent bosun, and then eventually, it wasn't until I was up at the academy in 63 or something like that, and I finally got a permanent commission as a lieutenant commander. So that was kind of a joy in our household.
He's talking about the Coast Guard, 3rd Coast Guard District was up here on Broadway, we had a Vice Admiral, he wasn't the full admiral. He calmed down. I think he was one broad stripe and one thin stripe. What's that? Rear admiral.
Rear admiral, yeah.
Well, I was stationed after I came out of the signal school. I was stationed over here on Pier 9, East River. And we managed the signal tower on Seaman Church Institute, which was on a tower effect. They built a wooden shanty on the catwalk around it, and they put in a door here and a door there, and we had a glass front that we could look over New York Harbor. And one day I'm up there with my cohort, and somebody tries to come in one of these doors, one of our side doors. Now, this was a restricted area, and I quickly went over and shoved my foot against the door and slammed it shut and said, "You can't come in here." He says, then he backed off. When he backed off, he had no shoulder boards on, but he had this gold striping on. And he said, "I can go in there, I'm your boss." So now I don't know what to do, because we had orders not to let anybody in that wasn't qualified. So I said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't go in here. You've got to go down to the barge office." So he went down to the barge office, and we had a lieutenant in charge of our detail. And he went down there storming mad about couldn't go into the signal tower. Well, his lieutenant says, "This is our orders come straight from Commandant, 9th States Coast Guard, and you have to have a special pass. Now, if you'd like to have a special pass to go up to the signal tower, we'll issue you one, Admiral." No, so he went storming out. I don't think he ever got his special pass. And about 5 minutes later, I got a call from my lieutenant saying, "You did right, because if you hadn't, your mother would have been hung, because he had no authority there. He wouldn't be in the commandant of the Coast Guard district. He had no authority in those signal towers." And
you know who spent some time here, too, that I'd forgotten about? Was Alex Haley. He got his early start writing, you know, right here, yeah. But he was a journalist, mm-hmm. third class journalist, and I guess he progressed from there.
Were you here at the same time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember anything about him?
I remember. As a matter of fact, see, he worked out of the district office there, the 3rd district office, and I spent some time there. I mean, you know, I knew him and all that, but I never sort of, you know, I figured with all his fame and whatnot, I'm sure he wouldn't remember me, but they have quite a collection.
I don't know about that. He probably has some similar memories to you with the Coast
Guard. The barge office here at that time?
Yeah, that's where I enlisted.
But it was the old barge office.
Oh, No, it was that ramshackle old hall there.
Yeah.
And Lieutenant Butcher, Chief Bosun Butcher had my orders. I have a copy of my original orders now. And I was going to look him up. I get a retired newsletter, you know, every month, and I was going to call him and get to him, and then the next thing I read the page, you know, cross the bar, and it was too late. That's the kind of sad part of it. There's so many people are gone.
Yeah.
It's a point where, there's no one really to talk to anymore, you know, about things like that.
Well, I think maybe it would be good on this tape to dispel the myth of the Coast Guard as being a very safe... would you talk to the issue of really what is it like being in the Coast Guard?
Well, World War One, the Coast Guard suffered the greatest casualties of all the armed service. It's only twice. When the Tampa went down.
But see, this rivalry goes way back. You know, like we used to go down Sand Street when I first came into service. I mean, you called hooligans. Well, if you weren't smiling, it'd be a free-for-all. And, you know, they'd say, step aside shallow water and let the deep sea roll in. Well, that's pretty stupid, you know, in this day and age. But at the time, you know, that was it. And for some reason or other, on these ships, some of the ships were Navy, like the Alhena I was on was Navy and Coast Guard manned. And there was some bitterness there. We were so adept at handling boats, and we handled landing boats. That was our job on these big transports. And, of course, the crew was a little envious. There were some hard feelings. They transferred the Navy boys into the boats, lots of accidents. Then we go back to the thing. But, by and large, this always existed. And it still exists today. Like... They Combat Veterans Association, they lose. I still, and this is a hang-up I have probably, I still resent the term coastie. To me, that's like a cold cereal. And I'm a Coast Guardsman, you know. But it's become popular. It's supposed to be an endearing term, maybe, but I even resent that to this day. But it just, you know, the Coast Guard fought in the wars. They took risks more so than probably anyone else. Maybe that accounted for the close bond between Marines and Coast Guard, because the Marines got ashore on the islands in the Pacific with Coast Guardsmen handling the landing boats. Our friend there, Douglas Monroe, the signalman, gave his life to
first protect. Congressional Medal of Honor winner in World War II.
It's one of those things. But I think you find that in everything, you know.
I think with the Navy, I can give you a couple of examples. As he said, the United States Coast Guard manned boats going through and back and forth through surf. So when they came along for invasion, who would they go to but the Coast Guard? Because we knew how to rid boats back and forth through surf. So that we went down to Little Creek, Virginia, and showed the Navy how to do that. Because the Navy always thought, oh, you don't beach boats, you put boats in the ocean, you know. So we showed the Navy how to do this thing. I think the greatest thrill I ever had is when we took a Navy destroyer in tow and took it into Jacksonville, Florida, Coast Guard cutter. And those guys in the boat on the destroyer, Navy destroyer, were red-faced when they went into Jacksonville, pulled in by a little teeny Coast Guard cutter, you know. So that we stick the needle in, too, where they stick the needle in. But if you go back into World War II, the very early part of the convoy duties, in the North Atlantic, the Coast Guard manned an awful lot of combat patrol vessels, convoy vessels. The cutters, and the cutters were some of the best cutters in the world, some of the best boats in the world for convoy duty. Your Campbell, your Duane, the Spencer, and some of those big cutters were the best cutters in the world, because where your Navy destroyers would go boom, 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 your cutters went through the waves a lot better. They built for this type of service. We did an awful lot of convoy duty in World War II. We lost a lot of our men in convoy duty. And another thing is, I think right now, we have our own uniform. For years, we always wore a Navy uniform with a Coast Guard shield on it. We now have a uniform that's a little bit more distinctive. It still looks Navy, looks Marine-like, seaman-like, but it's still a different uniform than Navy.
Well, you were actually in the Navy.
Well, I was in the Navy, too.
So you know...
I was called back in the Navy, yeah. And so I... And don't you think I got kidded, too, for being a hooligan? But I didn't mind it. Yeah. I didn't... your expression, Coastie, I didn't get that so much as I got hooligan.
Well, that's a present-day thing, that Coastie. Oh. You didn't hear that back during the war.
No, it was hooligan.
This is something somebody dreamed up, you know, fairly recently. Our lighthouse people, you know, the lighthouse guys are called Wikis. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When I was out at Napeg, being with the surfman out there, we wore a surfman uniform. We didn't wear our Coast Guard uniform. We wore a surfman uniform, which was a khaki uniform with a kind of a garrison hat, a single-breasted jacket, not the double-breasted that the officers wear, was a Coast Guard emblem up in each corner. And if you were the rated man, you wore a patch on your arm. And... the first time I went to New York City with a surfman uniform, I got picked up on the surfman show because they didn't know what I was.
And that caused a little hard feeling, you know, that we got... I wore my regular blues all the time, but, you know, if they saw a surfman or something like that, then they would get some hazing from the Navy, you know, stuff like that.
I told you that I indirectly was involved with that, the German U-boats that came up the coast and landed the saboteurs out of Long Island. And we did watches. We did shore patrol. And we'd walk 4 miles, 5 miles down the beach and walk 5 miles back. And we'd given 4 hours to watch that. Walk that. It usually was a 2.5 mile one way and 2.5 miles back. And the night that the Germans came ashore, I had come in from Hither Hills, which is all the way out in the island, back toward my station at Napeg. And as I'm coming up along the beach there, you'd walk, because of the loose sand, you'd walk as close as you could to the ocean, even if you got your feet wet, because the sand was hard there, and it would be a lot easier walking. And we are walking up, and for the 2.5 miles that I was walking back toward my station, this U-boat was right alongside me all the way up. And German swastika on the side, and everything else, U-255 or whatever the number was. And I come back and holler up to the signal tower that we had on the beach there. I hollered up. I said, "You see that off the shore there?" And he said, "Yeah, I got to report it." I said, "Well, good. I'm going to hit the sack." And so I went up and... That was midnight then, and I went up and hit the sack, and along about an hour or so later, my roommate, who was later became a policeman out in Detroit, Michigan, he woke up, and when he got up, he turned the lights on, and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'll go on back to sleep, they're calling some of the guys out, that's all." So I went back to sleep. And they got everybody up along the whole coast. John Collins, who was at the next station up from us at Amagansett, was the one that ran into the saboteurs as they came ashore. And he took their money and went back to the station and luckily reported it to his chief. And the chief put the call into the next station up. There was a radio, a regular telephone system all the way along the coast there. And they called the Army out of Riverhead, and the Army came down, and every Coast Guardman on the island came out, and they And I'm here, I'm sound asleep up in, I'm sleeping through the whole excitement.
They were the only people executed by the United States for the whole war, those four saboteurs. Mm. They caught them.
Well, they executed the guy down in Florida, too.
I just read it in a Newsweek magazine. I was over at the Coast Guard Library.
And they buried an unmarked grave.
Well, it sounds as though you felt you had good training.
Oh, yeah.
As a Coast Guard.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's no question about that. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, how do you, this is a very broad question, but how do you think being in the Coast Guards influenced your own sense of yourself or your identity or who you are?
Has enhanced it? Is that,
well, it could have enhanced it.
Because, I mean, it's a very hard to explain, but, I mean, all my, as I told you, early on I had a bent for this seafaring life, and then the Coast Guard gave me the opportunity to really become experienced. And then after I decided to remain in the service, why...
Do you know what you were making that decision based on? Why it was you'd make that
decision? It was based on, I'll tell you, as a matter of fact, that's a very good point. Because, to digress again from Ellis Island, I met my wife in 1953.
Why don't you say your wife's name and her maiden name?
My wife's name is Jean Hightone, and she met this Coast Guardsman. My wife was from Iowa. And she met this charming, handsome, dashing Coast Guardsman.
Yes.
And, you know, she knew from nothing about the Coast Guard. She was from Des Moines, Iowa. Well, I gave her an education. I showed her some books and whatnot. But, we went together for a while, and then she decided she was kind of leery about marrying a sailor. Well, I went off somewhere, I got transferred, and I met her again, and we fell in love, and we got married. Well, somehow or other, either I intimated or she assumed that I was just sort of in the service because of the war. See, again, she didn't know much about conditions in this country during the war. She was in college at the time. Well, after things calmed down, and, you know, maybe in the 50s or whatever, my enlistment was up again. See, I had a certain amount of enlistments. I'd be a Lieutenant JG, I'd revert back to Chief Boatswain Mate, and then I would re-enlist. Well, when it came time, we had our first house, and we had one child then, and she was literally shocked to find that I was going to re-enlist. She always assumed that I would get out of the service and find a job somewhere. But I had a lot of, I remember, soul-searching, and I faced the prospect of, she worked in an advertising agency in New York City, and, you know, I didn't know what to do. I spent 2 years in college learning how to be a mechanical engineer or some kind of engineering, which, I, you know, stood me in good stead in my life, too. But my heart was set on the Coast Guard, and I announced at that time that I'm going to stay. I'm going to remain. And she was stunned, but she very shortly got over it. And it was just based on what I really felt in my heart and soul. And that's how it was. But I had, you know, all kinds of ships. I had some really interesting jobs. Every ship I had, you know, I made some mistakes. I had a buoy tender in the Violet. I had the buoy tender in Baltimore for 3.5 years, and I didn't want to move my family around, you know, a typical military family. So for 3 years, I commuted between Yonkers and Baltimore, and that was tough. Children, tough on our marriage and everything else, but we survived, and then, you know, from there on in, it sort of became easy.
Yeah. How about you, Bill?
I met my wife in 43 where I was stationed here in New York.
What's her name and maiden name?
Pauline Ferrier.
What's her last name?
Ferrier. She was a local girl here in New York City. Worked for one of the engineering firms in the city when she got out of high school. We dated while I was stationed around this area, and then when I went overseas, we corresponded back and forth, and nothing serious. I keep kidding her because she changed me, and until I finally said, yes, I'll marry you. But that isn't the way she says it. After I came out of the service in December 45, I came back to New York City and looked up some of my old flames, and she was one of them, and we start corresponding again. In the meantime, I had enrolled in a university out there in Minnesota, so I was going to school, and I had no real desire at that time to get married. I was trying to get through education and college, but I guess time went on, and their letters became more appealing. The idea of marriage became more appealing. I guess I finally said, "Well, would you take a ring?" And she said, "I'd be very happy to." So that was in 47. We got married 2 years after I came out of the service, and we'd married here in New York City.
Do you think that being in the Coast Guards changed you in any way?
I think it gave me more maturity. I think that I had responsibilities that. The funniest thing is, when I went into the university, Dr. Reif, who was head of admission, asked me what my name was, what year did I graduate from high school, and he reached up and he grabbed a book off the shelf. It's from 1940, and he looked at it, and he went down to California Public High School. Oh, yes, there you are. And how do you think you're going to do in college? And because I see you ranked out of your graduating class, I think you're the last one in the class. And I said, well, and then you also flunked Ohio State entrance exam. And I said, well, Dr. Wright, if you can think back to 1940, what did a young kid coming from a rural high school in Minnesota have to look forward to? Either join the service, get a job, or go to college. Now, if your folks had no money to go to college, there was no GI Bill or no grants or anything. And out of our graduating class, I think there's only two people that went to college. And now, coming from a rural town, there was no jobs they had, and so you joined the military service. And so when somebody came in and offered you the Ohio entrance exam, it was a big laugh. It was a big joke in class. Depends on the present price of peanuts in Peru. You know, these are the answers that we put down because we had no thought of going to school. So that when I bugged my folks to get me in the military, and they finally said, "Well, the United States Coast Guard is a nice, quiet organization. We'll sign you up there." I think that. I had good experiences in the Coast Guard. I had good commanding officers, and I had some that was stinkos. And then the worst ones were these 90-day wonders that we got. I went to the school when I came off of quartermaster school. They sent us down to Advanced Navigation School here in New York City. Now, we had the same course the 90-day wonders had. The same course. We was in one classroom, the 98 Wonders were in that classroom. We had the same exam, the same test, the same instructors. They got a commission. We got a rating. And these were the guys when I went aboard when I was shipped out to the West Coast. I went aboard this ship. This guy was a man that came out of the ranks, was given a commission, and given the command of this vessel. And he didn't even know anything about navigation. So that he and I finally learned navigation together on the ship. We'd argue. We'd get up the bridge and argue about where we were in the ocean, and we would finally agree on taking a halfway between the two of our morning sights and say we're there. And sometimes we were right, sometimes we were wrong, but we finally learned navigation together.
Well, you said you became more mature. So did your aspirations change then as a result of being in the Coast Guard after you got out?
Well, I was on a seagoing tug most of my time out in the Pacific. And this one commanding officer that we had, I think, believed that he was paying the war debt. The year that I served aboard that ship, there was not one man made advancement and rated. And I'd go ashore, and you talk about going ashore and you're meeting your buddies. And I'm third-class quartermaster, and I go there and I see, Joe, hey, I see your chief now, you know. And he got out of the same signal school that I did, and his commanding officer moved him along. So in 1945, when they offered me another rating to ship over, I said, no, I don't want it. I'm getting out. You can have it. I don't need it.
So you felt that you weren't really fairly ranked.
No, I don't know. No, no. I think that I just happened to be assigned to a ship that, as the guy says.
But see, that's right. See, things like in life like that can affect your whole future. And what he's saying is so true. And that's not an isolated incident. I mean, I've been on ships where the commanding officer, I was on a great big attack transport that the commanding officer was a bona fide maniac. I mean, he was like a movie. You know, he stuck to his cabin. He never bathed. He was smelled. We loathed going down to his cabin and say, sir, the chronometers are round. You know, we held our breath. He was a tyrant. And as a matter of fact, when I got orders to leave a ship, I defended a guy that was unjustly court-martialed on a ship. And man, he was out to Shanghai me somewhere, and I hid down in the bowels of the ship for a couple of days until he got transferred. So, you know, this can affect your whole career. Mm-hmm. And, but by the same token, when I got to be a commanding officer of a ship, I treated my crew like family, and it made a big world of difference. Yeah. I don't want to, you know, it's mm-hmm. nothing to do with, you know, patting yourself on the back, but this is the way I am.
No, what I can't.
You wouldn't. I refused the commission the first time because of the reputation, he says, of 90-day wonders, and I poo-pooed. I says, I wouldn't serve as an officer, you know. This is my mentality at the time. But then I kind of realized that this is a good opportunity.
Well, don't get me wrong. I don't say all 90-day wonders.
Right.
We needed 90-day wonders, and they were called 90-day wonders because of they were college graduates usually put into a school where they were jammed full of naval procedures and commissioned, usually an ensign. And we needed the officers to fill in billets. But you did get some 90-day wonders that was good. I had a 90-day wonder from a shoe salesman from New Orleans that got me transferred off the ship. And I was the most happy guy in the world to get off of this darn tugboat. He thought he was shafting me, and he was doing me the greatest favor, because the next ship I went on, the first day I'm on that ship, the commanding officer called me up on the bridge, and he says, I'm going through your records here, and I see you've been a quartermaster third for the last 2 years, and we're putting you in for quartermaster second right now. So it was... But you see, there again, it was too late in the career,
yeah.
So that too late in the game, you might say. 1945 was there, and I had my points to come back home, so I never did get second class. My son right now is a chief in the Navy, and I always begged him because I said, "You should have gone in the Coast Guard." And he said, "Dad, I got more opportunities in the Navy." And I guess maybe he does. It's a larger organization. He's a chief. He's stationed down in Virginia Beach. He's got 18 years in. He was one of these guys that wouldn't go to school. When he was in high school, he was in crew. You know what crew is? That's mm-hmm. these guys roll the boats. Their crew won 13 straight races. We were given a high school jacket with champs on the back of it. So in his second year, I'm finding out that he's skipping school. So I go to his council guidance, the guidance counselor, and we try to work with the guy. I went to his coach. The kid was just, school turned him off. So I said, well, you got 22 choices. You're either going back to school, or you're going to join the service, or get a job. And a 17-year-old kid, you're not going to get a job. So the next day he came home with a paper and said, sign the papers for the Navy. So he went in the Navy. He's been in for 18 years now. He's made his chief. He's in charge of their computers down in Virginia Beach. He goes to Washington, D.C. about every month to work with these civilians. He's got it made. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the sort of social aspect of being with, and you're both good examples of men coming from all over the country and having a job to do and working together and being sort of in that male military society, I guess you'd call it. Is it like a fraternity? Or how do you feel sort of in relation to this entity that's the military service or the Coast Guard service? Or?
Well, it varied. When I, basically during the war years, it was a female-less society. And then after the war, there was no, maybe a few of the officers on a ship or a few of the crew. We'd have ship's parties on a smaller vessel. We had some terrific ship's parties where everybody would come. My wife would come down, the crew members would come down, girlfriends, wives. I spent so much time in the service at the academy. That was another situation. My Coast Guard wives up there were great, But again, I was a little different, a Mustang among all the academy graduates, but we had no problem. We fitted in. And we had our part of it. And even now, see, this is another advantage. I've been out of the service for a long, long time, but my place is still like a clearing. See, I still do a lot of business with the government, Coast Guard, Navy, and people come in, and they see memorabilia and my junk all around and whatnot. And they say, oh, you were in the service? Oh, yeah, I was in the problem. But it's still like a kind of a little bit of a clearing, but I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big part of your life,
it's a big
having
part
been
of
a
my life. It's definitely a very big part, and still. Uh-huh. I know now, of course, too late now, but I know I'll never lose it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How about you, Bill? Do you feel like being a Coast Guard is part of your life at this point? Or?
No, I can't really say I do because it's there is a space of time between when I was a Coast Guardman and when I'm civilian life. When I came out of the Coast Guard, I went to university. I've always been very active in Boy Scouting. So when I came out of college, I applied for a commission in the Boy Scouts and was commissioned as a executive in the Boy Scouts. So I worked with the Boy Scouts of America for 21 years. So I've always kind of had a love for the Boy Scout movement. I still think it's one of the finest movements for youth in the country. I'm not too happy with some of the leadership that we had in the last few years. Pardon me. I think they've taken a good program and tried to make it for every boy, and I don't think every boy wants to be a Boy Scout. I think that what Baden-Powell had going for him in 1910 was a good program. But to try and give it, I think the opportunity should be given to every boy to join. But I don't think every boy is going to want to join. And other boys have baseball or sports in interest. Mm-hmm. And I'm they kind of, they, to my way of thinking, when I got out 21 years later, they kind of ruined the program for me, so that I was, I went into the federal service at that point. I look back at a scout at my time during the Coast Guard. I look back on the good times and the bad times. I had some good commanding officers and some good duty station, and I had some poor duty station. But I think every GI can say the same thing. It's I have no animosity against the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm. Why were you interested in coming today here to talk about this? What is it that sort of draws you back to?
I think the main reason I wanted to, my wife and I wanted to come over to Ellis Island to see the immigration part of it, but I'm not interested in the immigration as much as I am in the other half of the island. I was on this island and off this island and on this island and off this island many times, and it was like coming back for new orders or for a new assignment or coming back for a training school. And I enjoyed Ellis Island. It was to me, it's a historical little island in the middle of a great big metropolis. I had some good memories on Ellis Island here. And I wanted to see, basically, when Bob... I saw Bob's notice in a military magazine, I think where it was, about any Coast Guardman that received their training at signal school or quartermaster school at Ellis Island. So I wrote to Bob, and he wrote back, and we corresponded a couple of times. And the idea of coming over to see my old stamping ground was intriguing. I wanted to come back, and not to see the Ellis Island, the immigration part, although I think it's beautiful and what you've done here is great, but I wanted to see the other part of the island, which was my home for off and on for many, many years and many, many months, many, many days. That I wanted to see, and I wanted to renew old memories, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about you? Do you know what drew you to want to come today?
Of course. I'm a Coast Guardsman. This is where it started. Yeah, I have lots of memories about those early days. I met through the years a lot of people that have been to Ellis Island. I got all excited when I heard about this trip today. I really enjoyed it. Of course, I've been so busy. That's been my problem, and I never take time, as they say, to smell the roses. But, I thought this was a perfect opportunity. Wonderful. I wouldn't have to fight the crowds to get to South Ferry. Where do you park or whatever? Mm-hmm. And Bob Isles contacted me through another fellow who was well acquainted with my deeply embedded Coast Guard feelings. Why, that's how we got together. Mm-hmm. And when he told me about this, I started to make plans immediately.
Well, now, is there anything else that either of you would like to say in closing?
I'm looking forward to seeing this old part of the island. I'm looking forward to seeing.
I read about, I've got, I kind of clip articles, everything I see on Ellis Island, and I'm not, I'm not too enthused about the future plans for the rest of the island. It's too bad, but by the same token, I realize we can't make this a mecca for Coast Guardsmen only. I mean, it's in the entire thing. It's really probably a small segment of the history of Ellis Island. But I just don't go along with this. I unless I'm wrong, I understand they're going to make condominiums and big meeting buildings, hotels, things like that.
I think there was some talk about ripping down your old hospital buildings and coming up with conference centers and stuff like that, which I'm again. I realize there's there's, you can't preserve everything historical. You can't keep everything that's old. Newness must come in the picture someplace. But I hope that we can still keep Ellis Island as, and I think you've done a beautiful job here on immigration. What I've seen is the immigration. It's been a big change since what I saw it in 1941. Dirty papers laid all over, chairs upturned, dirty floor, dirty windows, broken windows, pigeons all over the place. It's quite a change, and it's changed for the better. What you're going to do with the rest of the island, I don't know. But I hope it's going to kind of keep the
flavor of what it was.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what you can do with those the hospital buildings over there, but I hope somehow it can be preserved. And I think this is pretty much what you feel. It's we read these articles about what's going to happen to Ellis Island, and I know that for years. Was originally, I think Ellis Island was offered to New York City, and New York City didn't want it, and then finally somehow the Park Commission took it over. But I hope the Park Commission, and I realize the Park Commission's got a lot of problems, because I'm a Civil War buff, and I hate to see what's happening in some of our national parks with the Civil War part of it. The land is not being. And I realize land today is expensive, and you can't buy up whole counties because there's a soldier that fought there. But
one of the most disappointing things that have happened here is that poor old ferry boat. That was such a fantastic old ferry boat. And for years that thing laid in that slip, and I tried to make waves, pardon the pun again, lots of times. I belong to this steamship Historical Society of America, and we talked about it and all that, but to galvanize people into something to try to save that thing, and I just watched it rot, and she sunk right in the slip, and that was a crime. Mm. It's really too bad. Pardon me?
Well, they tried.
Well, it's on the bottom, yeah.
Well, they tried their best to, I guess, to raise it.
But it was too late. She's all...
It was too late then, yeah.
But ironically, in 1976, I think, we have a magazine called Soundings, you know, it has articles and advertising. And I have an advertisement for my business on the bottom of a page. And right over the advertisement is a nice picture of the old tug right in the slip at Ellis Island. Isn't that coincidence?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it when I was rifling through my old papers, because, you know, I save everything. And there was this picture. But that's too bad, because that played a pretty important part of the lives of a lot of Coast Guard.
Yeah, your liberty, that was yours. gangplank to the Manhattan. It was.
So it probably meant more to you as the Coast Guards rather than it did to anybody.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I want to thank you both very, very much. This has been most enjoyable, and you really had such interesting tidbits and ways of
telling. Got off to a rocky start, but I think things sort of came back to me again.
Yeah, they certainly did. Okay, this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I've been speaking with William Dorval.
Yes.
And Ludwig Lubinsky. And we're here in the studio at Ellis Island. It's May 18th, 1994. And I'm signing off. Thank you.